Chapel Service, October 1st, 1985, Page Lectures, Dr. Rosemary Reuther.
Today. She has asked me to announce that she will be delivering the second lecture, which is listed, Is Dualism Necessary to Christian Theology? Feminist Critique and the Problem of Evil. Tomorrow she will deliver the lecture, The Maleness of Christ, Can Christology Be Liberated from Patriarchy? We are happy to have her presence with us.
Good morning. Very happy to be here. I usually think that in the proper order of theology, one should tell you the bad news first and then the good news. So that's why I'm going to speak on dualism and the problem of evil today, and tomorrow talk about Christology. What basically is the problem of dualism in Christian theology? Why would one think that dualism is a problem? Basically, it seems to me the problem of dualism in Christian theology, and much of this comes from the philosophical heritage as well, is based on a confusion or a fusion of ontological alienation. Ontological alienation means the dualism of matter and spirit, a confusion of ontological alienation and social hierarchy. What basically is the problem that resides in this kind of confusion? First of all, it's a way of talking about gender hierarchy or other social hierarchies, hierarchies of class or race, in a way that confuses them with ontological dualism, namely the dualism of mind and body, spirit and matter, or their psychological analogs, namely reason and passions or active and passive. So one sees, as one of the basic problems, this kind of confusion between social hierarchy and ontological dualism. Now the basic question I want to address today, does this mean that feminist theology or other kinds of liberation theologies need to attack or reject dualism as such? Does it mean not only that they should criticize the dualism of social hierarchy, but also the underlying ontological dualism that has been used to express social hierarchy? First of all, we can say that logically or intellectually, the classification of gender difference or other social differences in terms of mind and body or active and passive or reason and feeling is, from a logical point of view, a category mistake. That is to say, the two genders or different races belong to the same human species, and therefore differences of gender or race cannot be characterized in terms of ontological opposites. Opposites are mutually exclusive. They do not share the same species nature. So to identify group difference in this way is intellectually a category mistake. But secondly, we should say that this is not an innocent mistake. It is not simply an intellectual error that has been made by some philosopher in his study, but it is a social ideology. That is to say, it is a way in which the dominant social group, namely, in this class, ruling class males, ruling class white males in our society, have defined subjugated social groups, women, black, etc., they have categorized these as the others. They have seen them as other than and inferior in nature to themselves, and by categorizing them in this way, they have justified their right to rule over them. In other words, the social dominance of men or whites is made to appear thereby natural. It is made to appear to be a reflection of a natural hierarchy in the order of things, in the order of being itself, so that the natural hierarchy, as it's of mind over body, rational over passions, is seen as analogously reflected in this kind of social hierarchy, and in this way, the social hierarchy is made to appear natural. In other words, the basic appeal of all social ideologies is the claim to be natural. The further question we might ask is, has this use of ontological dualisms to justify social hierarchy, to justify dominance and subordination, meant that these ontological distinctions themselves have been distorted? That is to say, we have distorted the holistic unity of psyche and body, the psychic and the somatic, into wrongly perceived opposites, ontological opposites. And that this dualism has in turn come to be seen as a hierarchy of being and value, a hierarchy of superior over inferior, of good over evil, so that mind, spirituality, is appeared to be naturally good, body to be evil. Rationality, spirituality, mind, reason, is seen as belonging to a higher sphere of being and value than bodiliness. The rational is seen as belonging to a higher sphere than the sensual. Now, the word sensual means is basically what we receive with our senses, but the very word sensual itself still carries in our language the notion of something kind of bad, the sensual. And in this way, reality itself comes to be seen as a hierarchy of being and value, with absolute mind or spirit at one end of the pole and unformed materiality at the other end. So this kind of pattern of thinking comes into Christian thought basically from Greek philosophy, which it is not essentially characteristic of biblical thought. But it is part of the heritage of philosophy in Christian thinking, and one finds it very, very characteristically, of course, in Plato, where he thinks in terms of a fundamental dualism in which there is originally in the very beginnings of things, on the one hand, some kind of pure, unformed, a pure being, which is purely intellectual substance, and this purely intellectual substance exists autonomously in some kind of heavenly sphere, and then on the other end, you have unformed materiality, and then the creation is essentially some kind of mixture of the two. And out of this mixture of the two, one has then in Greek thought and taken over into Christian thinking, what has been called the great chain of being. In the economic spheres, we might call it the trickle-down theory of being, in which one starts at the top of the hierarchy with pure thought and sort of trickles down to brute matter at the bottom. And in between, one has, of course, God is at the top, and then there's hierarchies of angels, and then there's humans, and then there's animals, and then there's plants, and then there's rocks. And this is the great chain of being, thought of as a kind of pyramid of being and value. So I think one thing to realize here is that the basic structure of this is based not only on the hierarchy of God over human, but very fundamentally an analogy of this hierarchy of human over non-human. In other words, the ultimate assumption is that the non-human, animals, plants, trees, and so on, are somehow inferior. They belong to a lower sphere of being and value than others. But then what also happens is that one arranges a human social hierarchy on the same model. A human social hierarchy is seen as participating in this same great chain of being. Although all humans, of course, are seen as having a mixture of spirituality and bodiliness, some humans are seen as having more spirit, less body, others more body, less spirit. And so that one creates a kind of a social hierarchy based on this, basically the same model of the hierarchy of the spiritual over the material, the human over the animal. Example of that, for example, you find that kind of pattern in Plato's Republic, where he talks about the three social classes, which are the philosophers, the warriors, and the peasants and workers. And he makes those analogous to mind, will, and appetite. So you arrange the social hierarchy really modeled on this kind of pattern of natural hierarchy. The philosopher Aristotle similarly thinks of a basic hierarchy between humans based on the hierarchy of mind over body. So he characterizes naturally his group, males, Greek males, particularly free Greek males, as the natural exponents of rationality and rule, sovereignty. And then proceeds to characterize women, slaves, and non-Greeks as the somatic people, the people who are intrinsically belong to the body, have a lesser capacity for reason and rule, and therefore, as he puts it, are the natural slaves. And so he categorizes women, slaves, and non-Greeks, or what he calls barbarians, as the body instruments of that group of people who are the natural heads or expressions of rationality and rule. And of course, the basic imagery of men as the head of the woman and the woman as the body, which one finds also in Paul to some extent, reflects that same kind of head-body analogy you find in Aristotle. Augustine takes over this to some extent, and medieval theologians even more so, who take over Aristotle in thinking of the male as having being the image of the mind. And this in turn becomes biblically expressed by saying it is the male who represents the image of God. So you have, for example, in Augustine, the statement that women really do not possess the image of God in their own right. They are in the image of the body, and they are in the image of God only when taken together, as he puts it, with the male who is their head. So what you basically have in Augustine's image of gender relationships is two bodies with one head. And that head obviously is male. It's kind of an interesting, you'd like to kind of do a picture of that and see how it would look. These two bodies with one head. Thomas Aquinas takes over very literally the Aristotelian anthropology and defines women as defective human beings, lacking in full human capacity for reason, self-control, and strength. So we see very much, both in philosophy and integrated into the Christian tradition, these kinds of patterns of setting up social hierarchy on the analogy of mind and body. The next question I want to ask is, how did we get this kind of pattern of thinking? That's always a good question, because in some ways distortions are never quite rationally explainable. But I'd like to suggest that we get it by putting together several kinds of tendencies in human being. First of all, I think we have, as a part of human nature, a capacity to stand out from the existing nature of things, to stand out from what is, and to visualize alternatives. And so that gives us in human experience a kind of basic sense of a tension between what is and what ought to be, unlike presumably animals. We have a sense that what is not simply all there might be, and so we can visualize better alternatives. Although my guess is that when my Irish setter bangs his food dish on the floor and points to his food drawer, he has some idea of a better alternative too. But in any case, certainly humans particularly have this sense of attention between what is and some other alternative. They're able to visualize a better alternative. And in visualizing that better alternative, they in effect construct a notion of what of the good that represents all those things that are lacking in the present situation, or the idealistic aspects of what one presently desires. So one construction a notions of the good, and then on the other hand, out of what one sees as negative in what presently exists, one construction a notion of evil. So you might say the good-evil dualism is really rooted in a kind of abstraction from the is-ought tension, that one kind of abstracts from that a sense of the good and an opposite of the bad. And those kind of dualisms of is and ought, good and bad, are always very hooked in many ways to our present experience. So what we visualize as the good alternative tends to be often what is lacking in the present situation. I remember Krister Stendahl, who was the dean at Harvard Divinity School for many years, saying that a Swede could never imagine a hot hell, because to a Swede, no amount of heat could be anything other than pleasant. I mean, a Swedish notion of hell would be an ice cave, you know. Whereas, of course, we've gotten the notion of a hot hell from people who lived in desert countries. And so we tend to abstract our notions of the worst alternatives from the extremes of what we presently exist. But in any case, certainly one tendency in human nature is that sense of a tension between what is and what ought, and then the abstraction of that into images of the ideal and the negative. Another very basic tension, I think, that's intrinsic to human experience is the dualism between, or the tension between the self and the other. And I would suggest that this dualism between the self and the other arises in its earliest form, and still, to a large extent, is experienced primarily as a collective self rather than an individual self. In other words, the notion of an individual self is a fairly late human development. And even today, if we would characterize our individual self, we would do it primarily in terms of collective categories. We would say, I'm a woman, I'm an American, I'm white, I'm middle class. All of these, of course, are collective categories. They don't just pertain to me as an individual. And so we construct our definition of our selfhood distinguished from other groups, essentially in collective categories, and to a large extent, our identity, how we identify ourselves, are rooted in collective categories. So you might say the basic experience of self and other is really an experience of us and them. And certainly this is very early in Christian experience, for tribal groups to think of themselves as the norm, the ordinary expressions of humanity, and to set themselves over against other groups as them. So us and them, you might say, is another very basic human tendency. And then a third human tendency, which seems to arise from the capacity to think and to have self-consciousness, is the perceived difference between thinking and that which you experience through your senses. You might say the knowing and the known, from which we get the notion of subject and object. That which we, the process of knowing, and then that which we see as other than ourselves, and which we perceive as object. Basically, it seems to me what happens in the kind of social ideology that I was discussing earlier is that these three categories have been all mixed up and confused together. So very fundamentally, what you have is a confusion or an identification of the us and the them, with good and evil, and with subject and object. So us, our group, which is basically the dominant group, the people who control the culture, the people who control
the intellectual structures, the political structures, they become the us. And they, of course, naturally think of themselves as the good, as the better, the kind of normative human beings who represent humanity in its best expression, and then they think of others as bad in the sense of worse or lesser than themselves, and then they also tend to think of themselves as the subjects and others as objects. And so that the whole perception of others in terms of body categories. But again, I would emphasize that this kind of confusion of us and them with good and evil and mind and body doesn't just simply arise from innocent human tendencies, but it particularly coalesces or becomes fixed into a social ideology when particular groups gain social dominance, gain control over the culture, gain control over the political structures, and then are able to categorize the others in terms of the worse and the somatic, and in that way to, as I said earlier, to justify their the naturalness of their power over them. I think this helps to explain why, when we look at social ideologies toward a variety of groups, one finds remarkably the same kind of pattern. You might say the basic way of categorizing others as worse is to categorize them as being lacking in sufficient capacity for self-control, sufficient capacity for rationality, sufficient capacity for exercise of power. So all the others are categorized as deficient in capacities for rule, self-control, and rationality, and are in turn identified with being sort of better at bodily things. They're identified as being more bodily and less intellectual in various ways. And I'd like to just run through some of those kind of patterns which we have inherited in our culture. First of all, and quite obviously in terms of sexism, one has this long pattern of male as head, female as body, male representing rationality and rule, femaleness as bodiliness, sensuality, lacking in complete or sufficient rationality, and so on. But one has a similar pattern in terms of class hierarchy. The notion of the masters, the aristocracy, as being the ones with the natural capacities for virtue, for rationality, for rule, and slaves, peasants, and workers as being more bodily, identified with the appetites, with being brutish, all of that kind of language. Brutish, of course, identifies them with animals. And we can see that in the kind of language that we use for working people, that we often refer to them through body parts, as of course we do women as well. We refer to them as hands or step and fetch it, so that as human beings, they are characterized as though they are simply body parts. Obviously, that carries over very much into racist language and American society. Whites as representing rationality, rule, capacity for higher culture, blacks, brute sensuality, and so on. We have a sort of odd version of that also in anti-Semitic language. You might say a kind of theological counterpart of that kind of language, where we think of Christians as grace and Jews as letter. Christianity as inwardness, spirituality, Jews as externality, carnality. That becomes applied also particularly to a language of money, Jews sort of as avarice, Christians as all full of spirit and grace, obviously. So again, that's a kind of analog to the mind-body dualism. And what that means is that the others are categorized in similar ways, not because they are particularly similar in themselves, but because the same group of people is doing the naming. The same group of people is doing the projecting of inferiority upon them, and then in turn characterizing themselves as having a monopoly of rationality, rule, spirituality, higher culture, and so on. When one examines this kind of language of racism or sexism or class hierarchy, however, it gradually appears that there are some funny contradictions in this language. And in looking at this kind of language, this kind of social ideology, I have come to, in fact, differentiate three different kinds of languages that are quite that are somewhat different, although they're interdependent on each other. One kind of language I see as functioning primarily to deprive subjugated groups of the opportunities for leadership, higher education, higher culture, and to confine them to doing manual labor, which the dominant group obviously doesn't want to do for themselves, digging ditches, changing diapers, and all these kind of dirty work. And so you attribute these lower groups as having a kind of innate capacity for stooping and fetching and so on, and lacking the capacity for thinking. So basically, in order to justify reducing people to certain kinds of manual labor and depriving them of the capacity for education and leadership, you first of all attribute to them stupidity. One attributes to them a lack of sufficient capacity for higher culture, that they're sort of innately more stupid and also innately more identified with bodiliness, and therefore they are sort of fitted by nature to do these non-rational jobs of sort of moving material things around. So I think that kind of language of stupidity and bodiliness is a language that basically functions to justify the reduction of certain groups of people to various kinds of dirty work and deprive them of the opportunities for intellectual leadership and political leadership. But very oddly mixed in much of our language about the others, and what seems at first glance to be quite contradictory to it, is a language of idealizing the others. That the others are not only seen as brutes, but they are also seen as innocent, spontaneous children, or people who are naturally fitted to nurture and to love. So that women, obviously, are both seen as more sensual, less capable of thought, but at the same time sort of naturally fitted to kindliness, to nurture, to love, to be the nurturing support system, obviously for males. So that sort of ideal qualities are also associated, that women are sort of not only better at changing diapers, but they're sort of better at loving as well, better at nurture, better at even spirituality, as long as it's thought of as non-rational spirituality. They're thought of as kind of better at intuition, so that they're thought of in some ways as more in tune with nature, less alienated from their bodies. And one has a similar language for blacks, for peasants, for Indians, that they are. We have both the language of Indians as the devil Indian and the noble savage, the sort of noble figure who is in tune with nature, who has kind of intuitive ability to, you know, understand the birds and the beavers and so on. So one attributes this kind of capacity for intuition, for spontaneity, for rhythm, for all of these kind of capacities which it seems to me that the dominant group has in some way lost precisely through the exercise of power and domination. They have lost these more spontaneous qualities, and they attribute them to the others, and they to some extent fit the others to not only to do exploited labor, but they also fit the others to be kind of nurturing support systems for themselves, to fill out these capacities which they themselves have put aside or identified with some alien traits. So that's a very, it appears a contradiction, but I think it's not really a contradiction, because in fact you can see how those two tendencies interact to reduce people to being manual labor, but also fit them to be the nurturing support system for yourself. There's also a third language, which is even more dangerous, although these other languages are dangerous enough, in which one not only sees the others as inferior bodily beings, but one also sees the others as being demonic. One sees the others as not only being brute, but being insect, of being vermin, of being dirt, of being disease. And whenever you have that kind of language, where others are characterized as dirt, disease, vermin, and of course, ultimately, devils, I would say that what you have is the language of genocide. Whereas basically, this is the language that says that these kind of people are not even useful in the order of manual work. They're not even a part of the order of nature. They really have no right to exist. They should be exterminated. And so whenever one characterizes a group as dirt, demons, germs, vermin, devils, one is basically saying they have no right to exist. They should be exterminated. They should be purged out, and so on. Now, what groups of people have been characterized in that way? In much of early Christian history, and probably down to the present time, that has been a favorite language for heretics. People who have a different theological view from yourself. Heretics are dirt, disease, vermin, devils. If you read the Church Fathers, it's very typical to use the language of disease for people with different theological views. So heretics have been a very favorite group to characterize as in this way. In Middle Ages, of course, various groups were thought of as consorting with the devil. They were witches, and so those obviously were thought of in this way. Jews have been thought of in this way, not simply as sort of useful bodily beings, but in real sense as sort of participating in the demonic. And that language was of course taken up very much in Nazism. If you read Nazi language towards Jews, it's all filled with vermin, disease, dirt, etc. In fact, the very notion that one would kill Jews with prussic acid was thought of as very fitting by the Nazis, because that was an insecticide. And since one thought of Jews as insects, that fit the Nazi mentality very much. Who in American society are thought of in this way? I'll leave you to think about that. I'll suggest that particularly, although we certainly have applied that to racial groups, we particularly stereotype homosexuals and communists in our society in that way. Communists are sort of the external devils, homosexuals the internal devils. And so this language gets applied to those groups in our society. Having spent a little time, you might say, wallowing in all of that kind of unpleasant stuff, which is very much a part of ourselves, I'd like to ask how we can move to some kind of critique and transformation of that kind of way of thinking. I think, first of all, we have to start out very clearly in rejecting this kind of language for social groups. We must reject all classifications of human groups, whether by gender or class or race or religion, in dualisms based on ontological and moral hierarchy. In other words, that it is inappropriate to categorize any people by group in terms of good and evil, superior and inferior, spiritual and bodily, rational and irrational, active and passive. All human beings belong essentially to the same human species. That is to say, we all possess a common human nature. We all possess a range of capacity for both intelligence and obviously physical work, and our whatever kinds of differences exist in terms of intelligence and creativity is basically individual and not group-based. And so apparent group differences in terms of intelligence or cultural achievement is fundamentally a matter of social advantages or disadvantages, advantages or disadvantages of cultural opportunity. In addition, It seems to me that all human beings have similar capacities for good and evil. In other words, it's not the case that some groups are sort of naturally more evil and others naturally more good. And this means basically that the difference in the amount of evil that certain groups have done is again based on their opportunities. In other words, it's not the case that women are naturally more moral. It is the case they haven't had as much opportunity to do evil. It's not the case that whites or men are naturally more evil, but they've had bigger opportunities to do evil. So it seems to me that one has to look at differences in terms of the doing of good and evil, primarily in terms of opportunity, the opportunity to do evil, in other words, power. And then behind that, we have to look at social structures which allow groups in power to abuse others. Because the more a social structure is in place that allows people in power to abuse others, the more they will, in fact, abuse others. Now, I think this also means that one should not expect victimized groups, such as women or blacks or Indians or whoever, to be somehow intrinsically more moral when they get into power. This obviously is not an argument for them not getting into power, because they have a right to get into power because exercise of power is a part of the human order. But one should not expect that when a black mayor gets into power that he is supposed to be more moral. In other words, we should be very clear that being victimized has never made anybody virtuous. Being poor is not good for your soul. Being abused does not make you kind. And therefore, victimization cannot be identified either with being naturally more evil nor having a natural capacity to be good. It may be the case, of course, that victimized people develop certain sensitivities to structures of evil. They're aware of that. And so they come into power as reform candidates. They try to change things. And so on because they've been sensitized. But that's basically an individual development. It is not the case that somehow this whole group has been made more moral by being victimized. So I think we need to overcome, as I said, both our inferiorization and our expectations that somehow this group is going to be naturally more moral if they just get into power. The creation of a just society, a society that will be more just, less exploitative, it seems to me is basically a function of creating social structures which minimize the capacity to abuse others and a culture which encourages personal moral development. In other words, moral development is much more a personal thing of people's own journey to sensitivity combined with social structures which inhibit the abuse of power and culture which encourage altruism and concern for others. And so we have to labor more at personal moral development and also at social structures which restrain the capacity to abuse and which encourage justice. But we should not expect that somehow if only a person from a particular victimized group gets into power, then all will be well. So I think that's one kind of thing we need to say. Now, going beyond the question of social ideology, I think I would then like to look at whether the underlying dualisms of mind and body, spirit and material have themselves been distorted. In other words, we have really gotten a whole distorted view of reality by using the tensions in reality as expressions of hierarchical dualism. And I'd like to look at that very briefly in terms of several kinds of dualisms. Thinking and feeling, mind and body, human and non-human nature, immanence and transcendence, and then finally the question of good and evil. In other words, the final question I want to ask is whether the good-evil dualism itself has been wrongly perceived. It seems to me the thinking, when we talk about thinking and feeling, sensitivity and intellectuality, as I said, I think all humans possess the capacity for both. We all have the capacity for both thinking and feeling, for receptivity and action. We all have ears and eyes, left and right brains, as far as I know. And therefore, it is inappropriate to set one group up as the receptive group and the others as the active group, but rather we need to structure personal and social relationships in terms of a mutual development of holistic capacities in people on both sides of relationships. Secondly, in terms of mind and body or soul and body, I think we have wrongly perceived this from the Greek tradition as being something like a butterfly in a box, as though mind were some, or rationality or soul were some kind of autonomous substance that was just kind of stuck in the body, rather than recognizing, which I think comes from more the Hebraic tradition, that soul or mind is in fact the interiority of bodiliness itself. In other words, that body and mind are really one whole system, and we experience the interiority of the body as mind and the exteriority, you might say, of the mind as body, and that these are interconnected. They may seem to have certain kinds of independence. You can cut off people's arms and legs and they still can think, but if you cut off their head, they wouldn't think too long after that. So that becomes very evident that the capacity to think is very much rooted in a certain somatic part of our being. And this basically seems to me that we must imagine eschatology in the Hebraic way as resurrection of the body rather than immortality of the soul. In which immortality of the soul is based on the notion of mind as detachable from body. Resurrection of the body affirms, may not know what that means, literally, but what it affirms is that we are a psychosomatic whole. Thirdly, in terms of human and non-human nature, I think we have to get over the whole false notion that somehow we have been put on this planet to rule over nature. And what that allows us to imagine is that nature needs us to rule over it. Now, a little reflection should lead you to realize that nature, that is to say non-human nature, animals and birds and trees and so on, really don't need us at all. They could get along very well without us. In fact, they could get along better without us. our Cocker Spaniel, he's been so distorted by living with humans, he might have a hard time surviving without us. But fundamentally, non-human nature can get along as well or better without us. Basically, it is the human which is parasitic upon all the rest of nature. We need it, and it does not need us. And this means that we need to learn to use our gifts of intelligence and technological invention primarily to fit ourselves in to nature in a way that uses it in the way we need to use it, but without abusing it, destroying it. In other words, to fit our use of nature into the kind of patterns by which nature renews and sustains itself, rather than using nature in a way that is fundamentally exploitative and destructive and proliferates waste and pollution and disease. And this has, of course, become much more imperative in modern times. And there was, many millennia of human relationship with nature in which people thought they could dump their garbage in rivers endlessly because the rivers were so big and humans were so few. But now we have grown so big that we are really in danger of destroying the very earth under our feet by our patterns of relationship. So our very survival, I think, depends on correcting our perception and therefore also our relationship with non-human nature. Finally, theologically, in terms of our categories of immanence and transcendence, Again, I think we have wrongly conceived this as though transcendence were some kind of autonomous heavenly world floating up there, and then there's the material world down here. Instead of seeing that basically what we're talking about in immanence and transcendence is the distinction between what is and its larger potential. Its potential for change, for transformation, for new things coming into existence, and that what we perceive in reality is both what is and that what is transient. It came into being from what was not. It can develop into something which has not yet been, and so that distinction between what is and its larger potential, and that we could then perhaps think of God not simply as the embodiment of the other spiritual world, but as the ground, the foundation of both what is and what may be. You know, in other words, what both existence and potentiality. Then finally, in conclusion, I want to turn to the good-evil dualism, which has the good-evil dualism itself been fundamentally distorted. I think it has been distorted to the extent that good-evil has been identified with these wrongly perceived hierarchies of mind and body, spirit and matter, and of course projected onto social groups as well. I think good and evil is not properly identified with any dualism of thinking and feeling or rationality and bodiliness, but rather good and evil fundamentally resides in the human capacity to distort freedom. The capacity to distort freedom, the freedom to stand out from what is and imagine alternatives, twisting this freedom into alienation, in which the creative dialectics of mind and body, psychic and somatic life, are turned into destructive and mutually exclusive alternatives or negations. So it's that distortion of the tensions of life into destructive alternatives rather than mutually interacting dialectics that I think is the beginning of evil. But evil is then, of course, magnified when these distorted patterns of our relationship to our body and to nature are in turn manifested socially, so that they become exploitative relationships between one group and another. And then finally, evil is further magnified and fixed or reified when this social abusiveness and exploitativeness becomes a social ideology in which the victims of abuse are named as the source of evil. So that we imagine that the victims are in fact victimized because they are evil. So that we justify our evil in the very name of goodness itself. So I think all those are the kind of patterns that we should speak of as the roots of evil, so to speak, and that they lie fundamentally in a distorted relationality. The distortion of relationality into hierarchy and into exploitation. And it's in that, so to speak, that we have both fixed our capacities for evil and also justified them, often justified them in the name of religion, so that we do not have moral and religious systems to critique our own distorted patterns of relationships.